Hey everyone, this is Arden Ballard, physician assistant, athletic trainer, coming to you with a cool new edition of Crash Cart. Today I am interviewing a pretty cool guy, in my opinion. I kind of geek out over a lot of the science-y stuff when it comes to sport performance and diet and nutrition, and I feel like Rob Wolf is a really good person to talk to, especially about a lot of the garbage that we see in medicine in general, but also in our sport, as far as some myths and some other cool things that kind of swarm the pits every couple of years. Let me introduce you, Rob Wolf. Rob Wolf is a former research biochemist, 2 times New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author, and co-founder of Drink Element Electrolytes. This stuff is really cool. I can't wait to hear more about this stuff. He also has his own podcast called The Healthy Rebellion. And he is a consultant for numerous special warfare, Canadian. And Rob, you have all sorts of cool stuff on here, man. It's hard to...
Been 5'9", given the how I've puffed up my resume at this point.
I dig it, man. Well, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Huge honor to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so... I know a lot about you because I've been using Element for a while, but why don't you tell our little guests a little bit about yourself and how you stack up with all this stuff?
Yeah. You touched it. So did a biochem undergrad and was looking at either medical school or possibly like an MD, PhD track, and became really, really sick. Ulcerative colitis bad enough that I was facing a bowel resection at the ripe old age of about 26, 27. And I knew enough about medicine at that point that I suspected that, you know, life was not really going to be all that exciting or people go on from that, but it really introduces some significant health challenges when you face things like ileostomies and lifetime of immunosuppressant drugs. And so in doing some research, around what could I potentially do to deal with this ulcerative colitis? And ironically, at the time, I had been eating a high carb, low fat vegan diet, which may work for some people, but for me, it was a disastrous fit for my genetics, my situation, and whatnot. And it was interesting. My mother had suffered what we then came to realize was interrelated. Kind of grouping of gut and autoimmune diseases, celiac, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Sjogren's. And it was her diagnoses that then led me to think about, well, gosh, a lot of what I have going on, it's very similar to what she has going on. And I started doing some research, and this was back in 1998. And this is what it was. I was trying to think, what got me thinking along this way, but my mother's rheumatologist told her that she was reactive to grains, legumes, and dairy. Okay. And I was, and it being vegan at the time, I was kind of like, okay, I get the dairy part, but, grains and legumes, like, what on earth do you eat if you don't eat grains, legumes, and dairy, And it was just this kind of free association thinking about that. I'm like, grains, legumes, and dairy. Okay, what is that? Like, it's kind of agriculture. I was thinking about Neolithic type farm and all that. And I was thinking, what did we eat before that? And this idea of a Paleolithic diet, I had heard about it somewhere, somehow, just this notion that, eating the way that hunter-gatherers ate might be beneficial. And again, mind you, this is 1998. It was pretty good jaunt back. And I went into the house, turned on the computer, waited for the computer to do its thing to cycle up, and then the old dial-up, waited for the dial-up to do its thing. And this newfangled search engine called Google was available. And into Google, I put the term Paleolithic diet. And I didn't find a lot, but what I found was interesting, that it talked a lot about gut and autoimmune related issues. And so I thought, well, I have nothing to lose here, because I'm about 165 pounds right now. I'm 5'9", 160, 165 pounds. At the low ebb of my ulcerative colitis, I was about 125, 130 pounds.
Wow.
So if you imagine about 30 or 40 pounds less of me, I was in a pretty disastrous health state, and so I gave it a shot. And for me, it was a lifesaver, and it was so profound for me that I really couldn't wrap my head around doing medical school at that point and kind of entering the funny thing. I was doing medical billing for an integrated clinic at that time. So there were MDs, naturopaths, and chiropractors all working within this same kind of integrated clinic. And I had this crazy idea, which was that if I'm going to go into medicine, maybe I should understand like the back office billing side before I get into it and everything. And so I actually had a pretty good understanding of how that stuff functioned. And even with this kind of alternative medicine integrative clinic, I just looked at what the folks did day in and day out, and it just wasn't super appealing to me. You know, it seemed like a lot of rigmarole to get around to what I would want to do, which is talk about sleep and circadian biology, movement, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. Plus this nutrition part. And it wasn't too long after this, it was about 2000, 2001, I was poking around on the interweb still, and I found this weird workout called CrossFit. And I thought it looked kind of cool. They had some interesting stuff in there. And my friend Dave Warner and I started doing this workout. He's a retired Navy SEAL. And we converted his garage into a gym. And within about, I don't know, 5 months, 6 months, we had 15 or 20 people that we were training. And I reached out to Greg and Lauren Glassman, the founders of CrossFit. And I'm like, hey, you know, we want to open a gym. We want to officially call it CrossFit. Can we do that? And they were like, yes, go be Achieve, do that. And I want to say that, so that was CrossFit North, which was the first CrossFit affiliate gym in the world. And then I had a chance to move down to Chico, California, and open what was then the fourth CrossFit affiliate gym in the world, CrossFit NorCal, NorCal Strength and Conditioning. And I want to say that both gyms were open maybe 3 or 4 years before we had any type of an affiliate contract. Like, it was just kind of this handshake deal, which is both cool and kind of terrifying at the same time. It's really cool that they had that type of faith in people. It also speaks a little bit to possibly how naive they were, you know, getting into this thing. But I mean, that's where I ended up, you know, working in the brick and mortar gym, and then also working for CrossFit for a good number of years, is where I just ended up working with just tens of thousands of people and learned so much about, you know, what does and doesn't work, and mainly keeping an open mind, because what works and helps one person may be completely disastrous for another. And that's been the last 23 years of my life, I guess. You know, I wrote some books along the way and have done some other things in the kind of startup world. Have definitely been heavily into the regenerative ag scene, maybe the last 5 to 6 years, although that's been in interest for at least 10, 15 years, thinking about the impact of you know, what our food choices have on the planet and kind of food systems and whatnot.
That's incredible. That's quite a story. I mean, I see a lot of students. I train a lot of PA students and medical students, and I see a lot of them coming through, and they each have a, you know, an individual story as to how they got there. But seems like your route really worked out for you. So I'm almost kind of happy you didn't go to medical school. I'm sure you are.
Yeah,
too.
I am. I mean, you know, and it's funny, the only I've directed probably 4 or 5 young folks into PA programs in mm-hmm. lieu of medical school. And I made the case that if you just have this burning desire to be the person in charge and the person who gets called every time there's a question, an issue, a problem, and if your personality is just that, like, you must be the head honcho person in charge, then by all means, go to medical school. If your main desire is to help people and to be able to be in a super dynamic setting where you could do anything from surgery to internal medicine and do it at the highest level imaginable, then be a PA. And, yep. and, You know, if you want a family, if you want a life outside of the career and stuff like that, then be a PA. So, and you know, it's interesting at the time when I was going through all this stuff, I was aware of the PA track, but it was, nobody that I talked to really gave it the credit it was due. In my opinion, if it had been on my radar, I would have done the PA route and then done like a 50-50 deal of that and running the gym, and would have had like a clinic facing, you know, part of the gym, and could have cut like 10 or 15 years off of, you know, the developmental process of what we did around all that stuff. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of the PA as a career path and a way to actually get in. And I can't really think of much that you couldn't end up ultimately doing in medicine other than having the kind of dick swagger of calling yourself a doctor, you know,
right.
But other than that, it's, you can do anything you want to with it. It's really the sky's the limit, and you can also put some boundaries around it. So it's not, you know, this all consuming thing. And I, of the people that I know in healthcare, the people that I know who actually enjoy what they're doing are PAs. I ironically, for the most part. Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, it's, PAs worked out, I mean, fantastic for me. I was at a juncture in my point after going to athletic training school and working exclusively with athletes, but not making enough money to move out of my mother's house.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to make some changes, but as a, you know, PA gave me the opportunity to broaden my outreach and broaden my scope without limiting my career path. You know,
right.
Like you said, right. Like I can branch out and go to, you know, work on kidneys tomorrow or something, or, you know, do psychology, but
right.
It's a wild stuff, but it's funny. You mentioned something that kind of struck me with, you know, the way medicine is nowadays. There's a lot of, you know, censorship, and there's a lot of, guided questions and guided literature. Mm-hmm. And, I was listening to one of your podcasts a couple of days ago, and, you know, you're talking about the exact same thing, how, especially the nutrition side of things, man. I mean, I feel like that there are so many, just false flags, and there are so many, just bullshit articles out there, that people take as doctrine, but that's leading them in a completely wrong direction.
Yeah. I mean, John Ioannidis, who's a remarkably decorated physician, has been pretty critical of a lot of the evidence-based medicine process. He wrote a piece, and this has been backed up by other folks, that perhaps as much as 80% of peer-reviewed, you know, medical literature is effectively bullshit. Like there's this reproducibility crisis where people will publish something, then somebody goes to reproduce it, and they can't get the same results. And there's all these issues, like if you do animal models and you're using rodents, Brett Weinstein it made this case back around 2002, 2003, that if you're doing any type of toxicological studies and using rodents, you're probably barking up the completely wrong tree, because these things have been evolutionarily designed via, you know, selective breeding to be super prone to cancer, but super resilient to toxic insults. And so using them as a model of, well, is drug A, B, or C safe, is ridiculous, because you've basically turned them into a variety of Wolverine animal that's just going to die from cancer eventually. Like, it's going to be super hard to kill. Then it's going to be like consumed by cancer. And so you've got this, like, there's so many damn problems when you really get into the medical literature, and so little that is really something solid that one can hang their hats on. And it's interesting, this gets really controversial, and you can have people tune out rather quickly, but I was having a conversation with a nephrologist, actually, and we were kind of, you know, some shots across the relative bow, baby, back and forth. And yeah. I kind of made the, you know, he was bringing up some, like, well, where's the evidence for this? I'm like, well, there may or may not be. And most of what you do in a day in, day out setting has no evidence-based practice in it. Like that, this was another thing that, like, depending on the specialty, upwards of 80% of what people do, there's never been any evidence-based studies upon it. It's just been what people generally right. do. And every once in a while, we discover, like, I remember a couple of years ago, we discovered that what we've been doing actually doesn't work. And this is the benefit of doing some evidence-based exploration. I remember they looked at MCL surgery. And so they did sham surgeries on people where they just kind of cut the side of the knee and stitched them up. And it, you know, another doctor wouldn't know whether they had the real surgery or not. And then mm-hmm. they tracked them for 5 years and they found that the sham surgery ended up being significantly better than getting in and rotoring everything out and all this stuff. And it was kind of like, wow. There's a lot of stuff like that in medicine, but every once in a while we assume that the things that we're doing that have just been passed down are legit, and maybe they're not. And this is some of the benefit of evidence-based, inquiry. But when you really dig into where the evidence-based medicine recommendations came from, the thrust for that, it came from insurance carriers, because the insurance carriers exactly. wanted to dictate what is going on. And the what I finally kind of beat this guy down with is that you are no longer a creative autonomous entity. You're here, crowing about the importance of evidence-based medicine. And by God, yeah, we always want to lean into like the best evidence that we have. But there was a time that you, when I was talking to him, you as a physician were autonomous and could think. You no longer think, you follow an algorithm that is given to you by the insurance providers.
Exactly.
You are superfluous. And then I wrapped it up with, and this is also why you will be one of the first professions to be erased via artificial intelligence, because they've just algorithmically driven all this stuff. And it's actually going to make medicine worse, not better, because we're not playing the clinical outcomes. We have algorithms. Hopefully you fall into one of these four or five buckets if you are a patient that needs help. If you happen to be somewhere in between these buckets, then you don't really exist in that world, and we're not going to have a goddamn thing to be able to do for you. So
they're already starting to do it. I mean, you can go on Kickstarter and see, virtual medicine programs where you could pay 10 bucks for a diagnosis. You just, go through clicks and stuff. And
it's
unbelievable.
Well, and the irony is that they have run head to head, have 10 oncologists assess your breast cancer diagnostic criteria, x-rays, blood work, et cetera, and then those folks put in their thoughts about what you have versus an AI driven thing, and the AI beats the pants off of that. Now the thing that I think is going to be challenging is some of these complex chronic degenerative disease states, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, gut issues. I think it's going to be a while before those get on top of those things get up to speed, because you actually need the programmers to be aware that this stuff is an issue, and still so many of the mainstream medical folks, they don't even believe that this stuff is real. So, which again, if everything gets algorithmically driven and it's all put down from the insurance carriers as the people who are kind of mandating what is and isn't included, you're gonna have a future moment. Folks are gonna have a future moment where they go to their healthcare provider and, that provider is going to assess them, or there's going to be a mix of like human and AI assessment, and your blood work's not going to be perfectly like, well, you've got a little bit of, your anti-nuclear antibodies are a little bit out of range, but they're not enough to say that you have lupus and, this right. and that. And an actual thinking practitioner would say, well, I think there's something autoimmune here. Maybe it's in the early stages, or maybe you're kind of an outlier. But we're going to implement some sort of an autoimmune approach with diet and vitamin D and, low dose naltrexone and on and on and on.
Right.
And that shit's all going to go away. it's just going to become a one size fits all deal. And this is the stuff I think we're going to have to fight really hard to prevent happening. If we want any type of autonomy around this stuff,
it's a really sad state of affairs. And, I was joking yesterday with a friend of mine. You know, there's a lot of transitioning in the world going on right now. And I said, the only transitioning I'll be doing is from a Western medicine practitioner to a functional medicine practitioner, where you can actually still think and use your brain and,
right.
And compare actually good literature out there. And it brings me to one of your points. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is because in motocross, our target audience is, you know, middle-aged folks who race motocross, and mm-hmm. some might have done it for a living for a while. And, there's a lot of stuff that flows around. I don't know why, but, you know, athletes like your ball and stick sports, they get all the top of the line research and all the stuff. And then whatever's left just gets trickled down to us motocross folks, but it's a highly physically demanding sport. Not too much unlike jujitsu, like I know you're a practitioner of, but there's a lot of bullshit that floats around. And so I was once spewing said bullshit for a long time, especially when it comes to hydration. Because we just said, you know, fluid in, fluid out. You know, if you lost 3% of your body weight in fluid, you couldn't go back on the field until you replenished said fluid. And we didn't care what fluid it was. It was just
right.
Get that water in. But your claim, and it's backed by a lot of good science, is that that's more detrimental than beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, the eye opener for it, there's kind of a long backstory behind that. But if we just crack open one of our, Guyton textbook of medical physiology, and we look in the index and find hydration where hydration is defined, hydration is the body water and the electrolytes that are associated with it. And those electrolytes have to come in a certain amounts and ratios. Otherwise, the system doesn't work. Like this is again stuff that we both learned, but I didn't appreciate from the hydration side particularly well until more recently. And every single muscle contraction, every nerve impulse is driven by sodium potassium pumps.
Correct.
And I can't think of anything more tightly regulated than like pH and electrolytes. Like blood sugar can operate over orders of magnitude changes, and maybe not be great for the person, but the individual will live. But like if pH or electrolyte status changes by just a little bit, you will be very sick and or die. And yes. So they're shockingly, tightly regulated. The electrolyte status, sodium potassium ratios, and where those things occur in the body are, we can't do anything. We can't contract a muscle. We can't beat a heart. We can't have a thought. Like all of that is driven by that stuff.
Right.
And for someone who's doing a sport that is physically very demanding, but also the penalty for the loss of fine motor skills is catastrophic. Like, and there's a lot of sports that it is, but motocross is maybe one of those things where like, if you have a little bit of brain fade or like you tell your foot to do, your foot, your hand and your hip to do A, B and C, and they don't really do it at the right time or in the right sequencing, you're going to have a hell of a day, It's going to go really, really bad for you. And hydration mainly starts getting on folks' radar once we get to the point of like cramping or like heat exhaustion. And once we're cramping and heat exhaustion, we had hours and hours and hours of suboptimal performance that related to poor motor control, poor decision making, poor like audiovisual processing, because funny enough, both our vision centers and our auditory centers are driven by sodium potassium pumps. So when you start getting behind the eight ball with regards to proper hydration, then even our hearing and sight end up being impacted to some degree. And so, it's an inescapable thing that we have to address it. And we're in this interesting spot generally with hydration where folks are really afraid of sodium because of its relationship to hypertension, blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease, which is legit. But we also, funny enough, you know, talking about evidence-based medicine and all that type of stuff, we kind of threw the baby out with the salty bathwater. You know, salt and sodium are players in hypertension and cardiovascular disease. But I would make the case that the driver of that situation is insulin resistance and the tendency for the body to retain sodium and not necessarily just sodium as a standalone item. Because if folks aren't insulin resistant, consuming either too much or too little sodium, the danger is on the too little side of that, right. You know, for the normotensive, insulin sensitive individual. We have great population level studies, and also we can kind of demonstrate this in the lab where you can kill people much easier by too low of sodium than too high of sodium, right. You know, within a certain setting. So yeah, I mean, it's critical for performance. To some degree, the element has done as well as it is done because people really don't understand hydration and electrolytes. Like when I sat down to, when this stuff started getting on my radar, it had been 25 years since I had fished around in my Guyton textbook of medical physiology, you know, but I really sat down and re-looked at that stuff. And I was kind of like, man, like we probably drink too many liquids absent electrolytes in it. And you know, we right. should probably be drinking a little pickle juice throughout the day and stuff yeah. like that, particularly if we're active and what have you. And, and there's almost been this, force field around the topic where, people are convinced like you need a ton more potassium than you do sodium, and you kind of do, but we'd like to get that from the diet, not necessarily supplementing super aggressive potassium. That's what they do when they give folks a lethal injection when they execute right. them. So it's like, you know, there's some interesting stuff that you want to unpack and really understand with that. But it's been fascinating for us in that it's hard to get folks to appreciate how important hydration is. Very few people understand really what that hydration means, water and electrolytes. And then when we're talking about electrolytes, in general, the main issue that we need to think about is more sodium than potassium, magnesium, and calcium. Although those are really important, but you know, if we're talking about an exercising group of people and what is going to make the difference between them succeeding or failing as it relates to like a hydration status, sodium is the more important of those, you know, mm-hmm. in that acute phase. And then over the chronic thing, then we want a well-balanced mixed diet and, you know, get our magnesium, potassium, and calcium from these other sources. But yeah, it's been fascinating that folks still really aren't sure if sodium is healthy for them. The kind of cool thing about that, though, is that if somebody is feeling off, if they're not feeling great, like let's say somebody's doing rounds at the track and how you doing? I don't know. I'm a little off. And well, let's top off your electrolytes. And they do a couple of swigs. And again, it could just be pickle juice. 5 minutes later, it only takes 5, maybe 10 minutes before electrolytes have really made their way into your system. And you're like, man, I feel like I'm really firing on all cylinders now. It's kind of the cool thing because I've used innumerable supplements over my lifetime, and you know, things like creatine. I know it's probably good for me, but I'm a non-responder to it as far as like noticing that there's any performance bump to it. There's some few other things that I kind of feel like maybe it helps me, but if you get your electrolytes dialed in, all of a sudden you feel amazing from that. And it's not subtle. It's absolutely immediate. And it creates this really tight feedback loop then where people can assess. They go from feeling like garbage and maybe performing like garbage top off their electrolytes and their hydration status, and suddenly everything is working really well. So it's been a really interesting, you know, process to watch how this has rolled out.
I love this article that you wrote on your website about some of the myths of dehydration. I think you just touched on all of them there. But there's a marketing goes into this too, right? I mean, and then the general consumer might see some of this stuff and be like, oh, well, you know, sure, it's good for me. I'll just pick up, you know, at the gas station and I'll go and get some Gatorade, or I'll go and get some of the, you know, insert name of sports drink or electrolyte drink here. What say you about stopping someone from doing that? Or is, you know, how is Element different from doing all that stuff?
The magic around Element is we're pretty aggressive on the sodium. Like you get a gram of sodium per serving, 1,000 milligrams. We recommend that you put that in between 16 to 32 ounces of water. And there's kind of different use scenarios where you would go at the higher or the lower end of that. I guess by contrast, Gatorade, and there's no sugar in Element. Gatorade, by contrast, is about 200 to 300 milligrams of sodium. So it's about a fifth to a third lighter in sodium. Ironically, when Gatorade was first formulated, it was a gram per serving. If you go to like the Gatorade Museum, Gatorade Hall of Fame, and you look at some of the original packaging, originally it was a gram per serving, but this fear of sodium that came up, funny enough, along with the expansion of like the industrialization of the food system and you know, our shift towards an obesogenic diet and everything, you know, we all of these things happen in lockstep, and we demonized sodium right at that same time. And again, for somebody who's insulin resistant, like they're not going to benefit from a high sodium diet, but interestingly, they don't really see significant benefit from a low sodium diet either, because their body is primed to retain sodium, and we can pull plenty of sodium out of our bones and other tissues to kind of prop that up. So this is part of the reason why hypertension isn't usually improved with a lot of sodium, although there are some situations where it is, but the real driver there is that we need to get people to eat better and have a better lifestyle piece so that we address the insulin resistance. Like if we don't address the insulin resistance, no amount of sodium restriction really ends up addressing the hypertension and whatnot.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, today's standard American diet is riddled with hidden sodium as it is anyway, right?
Yeah, I forget the exact number on this, but there's a slick infographic that suggests that if one's eating basically kind of a modern Western diet, 85% of the sodium that one consumes is in the matrix of these processed foods. And this is kind of the flip side. Like if you can get people to eat a minimally processed whole food diet, whether it's paleo or vegan or keto or what have you, usually their sodium intake plummets because they're not eating refined food. And what's interesting about that is again, even a higher carb, like vegan type diet, you don't get the same insulin signaling from that diet that you do from a processed food diet. And when our insulin decreases, then we tend to drop the production of a hormone called aldosterone tends to decrease. And aldosterone is the primary driver of us retaining sodium. And so when people do the good diligence of eating better, of eating minimally processed foods, the ironic thing is that they jettison 85% of the sources of sodium that they used to eat. And now they eat a diet that is really rich in potassium and magnesium, usually.
Right.
But what they really need to then supplement is sodium. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, but if we look at more traditional foods like Japanese cuisine, the way that Mediterranean diets are composed, you have these broad categories of kind of minimally processed whole foods. And then you have these condiments like kimchi or sauerkraut or miso or like pickled olives and pepperoncinis and stuff like that, that are really sodium dense. And so what we notice within these traditional ways of eating, we tend to have within these cultures, you know, chutneys and in Indian cuisine and whatnot, you have these really salty side condiments that have been part of the cuisine, you know, seemingly since their inception. And so what we have is broadly these low sodium diets, but then with this opportunity to kind of supplement the sodium on a per taste basis. And so when we look at some of these traditional diets, they have a remarkably high sodium intake, like the right. traditional Japanese diet. We Americans are told to consume 2 grams or fewer or less of sodium. Traditional Japanese diet has been in the 10 to 11 gram range for ages.
Right.
And they tend to have lower rates of cardiovascular disease. And there's a lot of other, you know, factors that go into that. But we have examples of traditional cultures that eat a lot of sodium, but eat a generally otherwise minimally processed whole food diet. And they do really, really well with that.
So there might not be an answer to this question, but there, you know, we have all this anecdotal evidence of, like you said, the Japanese culture living healthy longevity. And yet they're, you know, 5X-ing what our standard Western culture would deem acceptable as far as sodium intake is concerned.
Right.
So what's the conspiracy? Why are people, or why is this all hidden and try to be, you know, vanished from our particular diet?
I really don't think it's a conspiracy, but there is this, there is a reality that, so in my opinion, looking at cardiovascular disease and like the pathogenesis of cardiovascular disease, atherosclerotic lesions, strokes and whatnot, 15 years ago, I felt really confident that I totally understood what was going on with this. And as time has gone on, I get more and more confused constantly. But right. I think that it's really safe to say, like, I'm a little bit of a fan of like Malcolm Kendrick's endothelial damage model. Like, is it just lipoprotein and cholesterol levels? Well, they clearly seem to be doing something there, but
right.
they seem to be doing something in the context of when the endothelium gets damaged, then we have problems. And one of the best ways to damage the vascular endothelium is to have hypertension. And one of the pieces that can drive hypertension is sodium. But again, the we kind of, this guilt by association story, we assume that because sodium is a piece of the pathophysiology of hypertension, that it was the cause. But when we are insulin resistant, we tend to hang on to any sodium that we have in our system. And if we're normotensive and normal, you know, good insulin sensitivity, and if we go even further than that, eat a low carb diet or do any amount of fasting, there's this process called the naturesis of fasting. If we have a low carbohydrate environment, long periods of time between eating, our insulin levels will go very low, our aldosterone levels will go very low, and we will tend to shed sodium and water like crazy. And that is really where I think that the guilt by association occurred with sodium specifically. We know that sodium is a player in hypertension. We know that hypertension is a really significant risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And this is one of these ironic things. A great couple of studies have come out in the past couple of years looking at people who are managed down to normal blood pressure via medication, and it doesn't extend their life at all.
Right. Like
there's no improvement on that. Which is kind of tragic and interesting, you know, on a lot of levels. But I think that that's where the, you know, we know that sodium can play a role in hypertension. Hypertension is almost certainly a big factor in atherosclerotic lesion development. But the problem there is that we've put people on low sodium diets, and if they're insulin resistant, the low sodium diet doesn't really reduce their blood pressure. You know, it might bring it down a little bit, but it doesn't move it in this really profound way. Whereas finding the right glycemic load for somebody, like getting somebody on a moderate, low, or even kind of no carb diet, depending on the situation, that will bring down blood pressure every single time.
Right.
You know, and even intermittent fasting, I think it is really overhyped and has been taken to an extreme in these like kind of anti-aging circles where people are afraid of mTOR and growth, you know, insulin-like growth factor and stuff like that. But that said, intermittent fasting is interesting in that you will get a profound blood pressure reduction from the fasting activity, say like you're doing, you know, a 6 hour window of eating and then the remainder fasting, you kind of do that day in, day out. We tend to get a really remarkable decrease in blood pressure off of that. Mm-hmm. And above and beyond just any caloric or carbohydrate restriction that occurs there. So there seems to be a little bit of additional benefit to, you know, like punctuated eating as it relates to just that blood pressure part of the story.
Right. So, and I think more and more evidence needs to come out in relation to the gut and its severity and its density on so many different systems across the body and how it can relate to, you know, Alzheimer's and like you were talking about your blood pressure and you know, the chronic fatigue and the fibro patients can all benefit from just a good clean diet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, let's assume for a second that most of these listeners are, you know, relatively healthy, let's say. I mean, they might enjoy a Corona after their motos, and I mean, why wouldn't they?
Right. Right.
I mean, let's face it. Or some tacos or something on the way home. But, you know, if they're trying to optimize their diet, not only for, you know, longevity, but for performance, right? So you have some vegan folks on one side, you have some, you know, carnivore and paleo folks on the other side. There might be some balance in the middle. What are your thoughts?
I think how, and it's such a cop out. Like I had a more feisty, like stronger line I drew in the sand, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And I guess I've either gotten wiser or more complacent in my old age, but it's really whatever it is that can keep you at a good, healthy body weight is really the, you know, that your lab values look good. You are at a fighting weight so that, you know, you actually, you know, particularly for motocross, like this is a very, power to weight ratio, you know, consideration there, you know, just right. Thinking about the orthopedics of going off a jump and landing, like mm-hmm. if you're 5'9", like I am, do you really want to weigh 200 pounds or like would a 170 maybe be better on your orthopedics? And also the way that you're able to just manipulate yourself and your machine, you know, while doing all that stuff. So
right.
I think whatever it is that you do so that you have good lab values, you're insulin sensitive, and you're at a good weight for you individually for the stuff that you want to do. I will say that I think that for people who have significant health issues, you know, like keto and carnivore and stuff like that are really remarkable lifelines to throw to folks. If you don't have significant health issues, you know, gut, autoimmune and all that, then I think something that looks kind of paleo Mediterranean, where you're getting as wide a variety of food as you can, but it's kind of protein centric. Like we have some protein in the middle and then lots of colorful, you know, veggies and wide variety and everything. I think that is super valuable just from a sanity perspective, you know, so that you can adhere to that over the long haul. I see vegan diets being challenging for folks in that the to get adequate levels of protein, you inevitably end up consuming more calories than what you need, or you end up using a remarkable amount of kind of protein concentrate items, you know, hemp protein and pea protein and stuff like that. And that can work. That can certainly work for folks. I think that a lot of folks that tend towards that vegan side of the story, they've been scared into low protein approach because of fears of mTOR and cancer and stuff like that. And I have one of the best talks I've ever done, and it came out. I only did it one time right before COVID hit, and then like the world got locked down. And
right.
I ended up recording it privately and then just sticking it online. And if you search Rob Wolf longevity, you can find this YouTube talk. It's about an hour and 15 minutes, but the title is Longevity, Are We Trying Too Hard? So for the people that are concerned that like eating protein in general and animal protein in particular is going to give them cancer and accelerate aging, I kind of put some pretty strong context around all that stuff. But you know, I think the best diet for jujitsu or racing or what have you is going to in large part boil down to what is it that's going to work for you. You know, the adherence is going to be a big factor. And then the greater your health needs are, like for me, I have a lot of gut issues. Like I still do. Mm-hmm. They're managed because of the way that I eat and the way that I live. So I have no symptoms. I effectively have no problems so long as I stay within certain guidelines, but I can't have gluten. I have celiac disease. So I have this autoimmune reaction to gluten. I have to be careful with that. I can do a little bit of carbs, and I've interestingly gotten more carb sensitive or tolerant over the past maybe 5 years than what I was prior to that. But I still like, even on a hard training day, about 120 grams of carbs is about the most that I can handle without feeling bad. You know, I'll get on this blood sugar roller coaster and foggy headed and stuff like that. And I don't know if that's like a histamine issue or if it's just straight up blood sugar, but there's something that goes haywire there, you know?
Right.
And so I have to eat a little bit on the lower carb side of things. But if you don't have to cater to poor insulin sensitivity, gut issues, autoimmunity, then I think you look towards kind of a protein centric model, minimally processed whole foods. And then I try to de-emotionalize eating. I don't like the notion of cheat days. Like if you want something, have it. Like don't turn it into the equivalent process of like a heroin addict thinking about getting their box out and opening the lid and getting the spoon and the rubber ligament, because that anticipatory stuff really gets the dopamine centers of the brain going and that kind of addictive process, you know, starts getting set up. So I try to encourage people, like if you want to have something, have it, but if you're going to have ice cream or a dessert or something like that, have it when you're out. Try not to have that stuff in the house.
Right.
Try to keep the house pretty pristine, because nobody lays in bed at night thinking about the chicken breast and broccoli. It's like the Little Debbie snack cakes. And, you know, for me, it's salty, crispy stuff. Like I've never met a corn chip, never met a nacho that I would not be, you know, intimate friends with. And like sweet stuff, I'm kind of like, I can take it or leave it. It's not a big deal, but salty.
That's why you founded a salt
things,
company then.
It is kind of ironically probably why I ended up there and not some sort of sugar deal. Like nachos and even like pizza or things like kimchi and sauerkraut. And there's no off switch for me with that stuff. So I have to be really smart about what I have in the house. Like I could have a couple of bricks of dark chocolate. I might have a piece or two a month, but if I have some corn chips at home, I'm going to actively figure out ways of passing through the kitchen. Cause you know, well, I worked out hard today, so I can handle a couple more chips and I will actively go out of my way to do that. And Gretchen Rubin talks about, this stuff within the four tendencies and her kind of personality typing. And you know, abstainers versus moderators. And it's interesting. I can moderate most things. Like I could take or leave donuts and chocolate and stuff like that. But with salty, crunchy things, I have to be an abstainer. There is no off switch for me with that. Like there is no, there is not eating one or two pieces of nacho. There is not doing one or two corn chips into guacamole or you know, good salsa. It's the whole damn tray and then the next tray and the next tray for me. Yeah.
I tell people in clinic all the time, if you're serious about this, you need to have a moment and just, like you said, cannot connect or disconnect the emotional component to eating. And I live in the South. So, I mean, we're raised around food. Everything is done around food. So, you know, some people it's harder than others, but you know, a fundamental approach is you got to get the dopamine out of it and then just start shopping the perimeter of your local grocery store. And then, you know, from there, then you can start to integrate a little bit more, but it's, for some people, it's a massively difficult undertaking.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Well, man, this has been great. This has been great for me. I hope it's great for everybody else. You know, two other people that listen perhaps, but, you know, what else can we add? I really want to focus on, you know, the salt side of things. You mentioned something when you were talking about Element. The standard American diet recommends under 2 grams of sodium per day. But you know, the research has shown that, you know, 5 to 7 maybe might be a little bit more beneficial for us, especially the athlete. It might be more. You have any, you know, parting things to say about that?
Yeah, we've done some interesting work with like NHL teams, you know, big, strong, muscular guys, not huge, but 200, 220 pounds. And these guys, through the course of a hard practice or a game, can lose upwards of 10 grams, 10,000 milligrams of sodium in a hard practice or game. And so if they are then told to only consume 2 grams, 2,000 milligrams or less as part of a, quote, balanced, healthy diet, they're never going to get there. It's kind of like, you know, most people are familiar with like female athlete triad, you know, where like women will undereat and then they will overtrain and then they'll end up with this deal where they're amenorrheic and all this stuff going on. I think a fourth piece to that, or another piece to that, is a lot of women specifically under consume sodium, which is a stress. It is another stress. It's a stress like too much exercise. It's a stress like too few calories. And this stress ends up being a huge factor on sleep and recovery and whatnot. But think about, a lot of some folks do motocross in the winter and cooler months, like you know, and again, like if you live in the Southern US, it may be cold, but you can bundle up and figure out gear where you can, you can make that work, and you'll still sweat doing that because of the physical, you know, kind of component of it. But I'd say by and large, like people really get after it in the hot months, you know, that's when, you know, maybe some of the best writing is available, and you're going to sweat like crazy. And if you're not replenishing that sodium, and the American Council of Sports Medicine, ACSM, their guidelines, and this is assuming people are eating like a standard, you know, kind of mixed Western diet, high carb and all that, those folks recommend between 7 and 10 grams of sodium per day for athletes at high motor output, high heat, high humidity. And, you know, when people are largely wearing like leathers or protective gear and whatnot, it's gonna be hot. You know, there's no two ways around that. And so they're almost implicit, and they're in the sun usually. So it's just almost implicitly this scenario where you're gonna have a high heat, high humidity, high workload environment, which is probably gonna push you right up to the top end of the sodium needs. And I've worked with people that, and some of them have been small females that are in the 12 to 15 gram per day range of sodium. Now, these tend to be gals that have had autoimmune issues. They want to function at a high level. Like one of them's in jujitsu, one of them's a CrossFitter, and so super high motor output, but they're in that like 12, 15 grams of sodium per day range. It's really remarkable. And we've tinkered with dialing them down, and we immediately see like their heart rate variability, you know, their recovery does not do what we want it to do. They're not sleeping as well. They physically, they're just like, oh, I'm not as recovered as what I was, you know, when things were at a higher sodium intake. So it's a pretty objective measure as far as all that goes. Yeah. But that would be the thing I would get, I guess, would leave with people is, just get in and tinker. Like if you're in, you know, yeah. at drinkelement.com, we have, a really robust and ever growing list of articles there. And, we get in and talk about like, well, how do you know if you need more sodium and electrolytes in general? Like what are the kind of the physical characteristics and how can you tell when you've hit the right level and where to go with that? And my greasy used car salesman pitch is to just tinker and see if you need a little bit more, you know, and you will be able to figure out fairly easily what is optimum for you. And that will change based off the day and the circumstance. If I'm mainly at home and relatively sedentary, I may only need 4 or 5 grams of sodium in that day. On a mm-hmm. day that I do jujitsu, I may be closer to 7. If I do jujitsu and some strength training, I may be closer to 10. So it will vary based off of heat, activity, altitude, and a couple other factors.
You said it. And I think, you know, if you're taking your helmet off and you notice like huge sweat rings and, you know, if you're a big sweater or if you're not a big sweater, that's going to alter your diet and alter how you plan your approach to all this stuff. All right. Before you go, I have to ask one question here on your little tidbits. It says you took down a 650-pound elk with a spear.
It's technically an atlatl. Yeah.
Atlatl.
Yeah. So it's
how the hell did you do that?
I was on a show called I Caveman, which was a Discovery Channel reality show. And they got 10 people together, 5 men, 5 women. And they had a couple of people that had really solid survival skills. Like this guy, Billy Berger, is like a survival primitive skills expert. He can flint knap anything and make stone tools. I was kind of one of the moderately competent people. And then they had people that if you take them out of Los Angeles, like they're going to die in 5 minutes.
Right.
So they put us all together. They put us outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado in early June and gave us a basic Paleolithic kit, including clothing and the beginnings of a flint knapping deal. And we had to just live that way. And where they put us in Steamboat Springs, it was 8,300 feet elevation. It was pretty good elevation. And in June, there was still snow on the ground. Like they wanted it to look like glacial Europe. Mm-hmm. And I when I agreed to do the show, I thought it was going to be either in Kentucky or North Texas, which I was like, oh, there will be tons of food there. And then when I found out it was going to be in Steamboat Springs, Colorado in the early spring, right. I was like, we're going to starve to death. And the first 2 weeks, like we got nothing. Like we caught a couple of fish, we ate some frogs, a few random things. This divided among like 10 people, but we managed to get our kit together and make the atlatl spears are like 6-7 feet long and they're flexible. Like they have a spine similar to regular archery. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a launcher that you hold and you put the dart on the launcher and you throw it kind of like a highlight type deal. And it flexes and explodes off there. There was a different like History Channel show that talks about warfare and armament and everything. And they made the case that a well-thrown, atlatl dart can have the impact of a 270 Winchester round, really remarkable amount of impact. But yeah, I got a rather large elk in the neck at about a 35 to 40 yard shot. And as far as I know, this is still like the Boone and Crockett world record for the largest land animal taken in recorded history, you know, modern history, with an atlatl. And that's in due in large part that it's illegal most places to hunt most animals with an atlatl, because it's such an incredibly variable thing. Like, I practiced a lot with the atlatl, and I was aiming for the shoulder, and I got it in the neck at 30 or 40 yards. And like, if I had even a fundamental, you know, recurve or longbow, that would have been a reasonably easy shot, you know, at 30 or 40 yards. And with the atlatl, you're just hucking this thing. So, yeah. And I missed the first shot. I had two darts. I missed the first shot and then got the second shot. Yeah.
So don't mess with Rob or he'll atlatl you.
I'll atlatl you. Yes. And if you're 35 yards away, you were 100% safe, but anything within 30 yards, it could be bad. Yeah.
Well, Rob, thank you so much, man. I've learned a lot. I hope everyone else has learned a lot. I hope to do this again one day. This has been great.
Anytime you want me to bring down property values, I'll do it. I will come back anytime you want. So thank you.
All right, man. We'll talk soon.
Thanks. Take care.